was the standard-bearer for the Federalist Party. But Jefferson had always realized that Adams did not fit into the party grooves. I happened to cite it from you, though the whole letter shows I had them only in view, Jefferson explained. In truth, my dear sir, we were far from considering you as the author of all the measures we blamed. They were placed under the protection of your name, but we were satisfied they wanted much of your approbation. Notice the collective we, an inadvertent acknowledgment of the coordinated campaign of the Republican Party. Adams, in effect, happened to be in the line of fire, which was really directed at the Hamiltonian wing of the Federalist Party. You would do me great injustice, therefore, Jefferson concluded, by taking to yourself what was intended for men who were your secret, as they are now your open enemies. Jefferson's explanation was ingenious. It shifted the blame for the rupture of the friendship onto the Hamiltonians, whom he knew Adams utterly despised, then invited Adams to align himself, at least retrospectively, with the Republican side of the debate. The trouble with Adams, of course, was that he was unwilling to align himself with any political party. Indeed, his trademark had always been to embody the virtuous ideal, the Washington quasi-monarchical model of executive leadership, and stand above party. The clear, if unspoken, message of Jefferson's letter was that this admirable posture was no longer possible in American politics. Adams had gotten himself caught in the crossfire created by the new conditions and the partisan imperatives they generated. Most important, from the point of view of the friendship, Jefferson admitted that his behind-the-scenes criticism of Adams had been a willful misrepresentation. While not really an apology, indeed forces beyond his control had dictated his actions, this was at least a major concession. Adams's immediate impulse was to fire off several illumination rounds designed to expose the inaccuracies in Jefferson's account of the Adams presidency, inaccuracies that Jefferson had already acknowledged. I have no thought in this correspondence but to satisfy you and myself, Adams observed, adding, My reputation has been so much the sport of the public for 50 years, and will be with posterity, that I hoped it a bubble, a gossamer that idles in the wanton summer air. Jefferson had mentioned the Alien and Sedition Acts as a major source of partisan hatred. As your name is subscribed to that law as vice president, Adams declared, and mine as president, I know not why you are not as responsible for it as I am. Jefferson had used the phrase the terrorism of the day to describe the supercharged atmosphere of the late 1790s. Adams launched into a frenzied recollection of the mobs gathered around his house, protesting his decision to send a peace delegation to France. I have no doubt you was fast asleep in philosophical tranquility, Adams noted caustically, when 10,000 people and perhaps many more were parading the streets of Philadelphia. What think you of terrorism, Mr. Jefferson? Jefferson had blamed the Federalists for the lion's share of the party mischief. Adams thought the blame was equally shared. Both parties have excited artificial terrors, he concluded, and if I were summoned as a witness to say upon oath, I could not give a more sincere answer than in the vulgar style. Put them in a bag and shake them, and then see which comes out first. However anachronistic it might seem to Jefferson, he, John Adams, would go to his grave defying party politics. This was the defining moment in the correspondence. In the summer of 1813, the dialogue ceased being a still-life picture of posed patriarchs and became an argument between competing versions of the revolutionary legacy. All the unmentionable subjects were now on the table because a measure of mutual trust had been recovered. The best bellwether of the Adams psyche was always Abigail, and on July 15, 1813, she appended a note to her husband's letter, her first communication with Jefferson since the lacerating letters she had written him 9 years earlier. "I have been looking for some time for a space in my good husband's letters to add the regards of an old friend," she now wrote, "which are still cherished and preserved through all the changes and vicissitudes which have taken place since we first became acquainted, and will, I trust, remain as long as A. Adams." Abigail's voice, as always, was the surest sign. Jefferson had been forgiven. The friendship so long in storage had never completely died. The recovered sense of common affection and trust now made it possible to act on Adams's classic pronouncement that they ought not die before they had explained themselves to each other. Although Adams tended to set the intellectual agenda in the dialogue that ensued, Jefferson inadvertently provided the larger framework within which the debate played out. He was actually trying to make amends for his unfair characterization of Adams in the Priestley letter as one of the ancients. He now wanted to go on record as agreeing with Adams that while the progress of science was indisputable, certain political principles were eternal verities that the ancients understood as well as the moderns. "The same political parties which now agitate the U.S. have existed through all time," he observed, "and, in fact, the terms of Whig and Tory belong to natural as well as to civil history. They denote the temper and constitution and mind of different individuals." Was this Jefferson's roundabout way of suggesting that he and Adams had in effect been acting out a timeless political argument? As the lengthy letter proceeded, it became clear that Jefferson was in fact attempting to place his friendship and eventual rivalry with Adams within a broader context, to see it through the more detached lens of history. In the Jeffersonian version of the story, Adams and Jefferson fought shoulder to shoulder against the Tories, served together in Europe as a dynamic team, then returned to serve again in the new national government. And then the classic distinction appeared again. The line of division was again drawn. We broke into two parties, each wishing to give a different direction to the government, the one to strengthen the most popular branch, the other the more permanent branches, and to extend their performance. Here you and I separated for the first time, and as we had been longer than most in the public theatre, and our names were more familiar to our countrymen, the party which considered you as thinking with them placed your name at the head, the other, for the same reason, selected mine. We suffered ourselves, as you so well expressed it, to be the passive subjects of public discussion. And these discussions, whether relating to men, measures, or opinions, were conducted by the parties with an animosity, a bitterness, and an indecency which had never been exceeded. To me, then, it appears that there have been differences of opinion and party differences from the first establishment of governments to the present day, and on the same question which now divides our own country, that these will continue through all future time, that everyone takes his side in favor of the many or the few, according to his constitution and the circumstances in which he is placed. Here was the classic Jeffersonian vision, and the beautiful simplicity of its narrative structure makes it even more clear why Adams was absolutely right to admire Jefferson's knack for fitting himself into a storyline with immense appeal to future historians. Jefferson's mind consistently saw the world in terms of clashing dichotomies, Whigs versus Tories, moderns versus ancients, America versus Europe, rural conditions versus urban, whites versus blacks. The list could go on, but it always came down to the forces of light against the forces of darkness, with no room for anything in between. What Adams calls a romance was actually a melodrama, and the specific version Jefferson was now offering Adams cast the Federalists in the role of latter-day Tories who had betrayed the expansive legacy of the American Revolution, the corrupt guardians of the privileged few aligned defiantly against the Jeffersonian many. But how could this be? Even Jefferson seemed to acknowledge that Adams did not quite fit into this rigid formula. If your objects and opinions have been misunderstood, Jefferson noted, if the measures and principles of others have been wrongly imputed to you, as I believe they have been, that you should leave an explanation of them would be an act of justice to yourself. In effect, if Adams had a different story to tell, if he saw a different pattern in the historical swirl they had both lived through, he should write out his account and let posterity judge. Adams, of course, had been trying to do just that for over a decade, and, as we have seen, the result had been a bewildering jumble of tortured protestations, endless harangues, and futile displays of wounded pride, all leading to the rather disquieting conclusion that there was no pattern to be discovered, only one invented by fiction writers masquerading as historians. Glimmers of an un-Jeffersonian outline peeked through the cloud of words Adams had spewed out. The neat divisions between Whigs and Tories did not accord with the Adams sense of the political landscape during the 1770s. Between a third and a half of the American people, he guessed, had been indifferent and floated with the prevailing tide of the moment. The divisions of the 1790s did not match up with Jefferson's categories either, since those supporting and those opposing a more powerful national government had all been good Whigs. Certainly neither he nor Washington had viewed themselves as traitors to the revolutionary cause. They had regarded their Federalist programs as a fulfillment rather than a betrayal of American independence. Nor did Jefferson's distinction between the few and the many work very well south of the Potomac, except in the ironic sense that only a few Virginians were willing to address the forbidden subject that shaped their lives, their fortunes, and that cast a long shadow over their sacred honor. But glimmerings do not a story make. Jefferson had a story. In the absence of a coherent alternative with equivalently compelling appeal, his story was destined to dominate the history books. Adams sensed that it was not the true story, even doubted whether such a thing as a true story existed. But once Jefferson laid it out before him so elegantly in the summer of 1813, Adams at last possessed a target on which to focus his considerable firepower. He was utterly hopeless as a grand designer of narratives, and he knew it. The artifice required to shape a major work of history or philosophy was not in him, but he was a natural contrarian, a born critic whose fullest energies manifested themselves in the act of doing intellectual isometric exercises against the fixed objects presented by someone else's ideas. Jefferson now became the fixed object against which he strained. The conversational format of the correspondence with Jefferson also suited his temperament perfectly, since it permitted topics to pop up, recede, then appear again episodically without any pretense of some overall design, the give-and-take rhythms of the dialogue matching nicely the episodic surgings of his own mind. As a result, no neatly arranged rendering of the running argument Adams had with Jefferson after 1813 can do justice to its dynamic character. All one can do is to identify the major points of contention, then impose a thematic order that draws out the deeper implications of the argument, all the while knowing that the coherence that results is itself a construction. The major argument running through the letters throughout 1813 to 1814 concerned their different definitions of social equality and the role of elites in leading and governing the American Republic. Without ever saying so directly, they were talking about themselves and the other prominent members of the revolutionary generation. The argument was prompted by Jefferson's long letter on the few and the many, and his accompanying assertion that the eternal political question had always been whether the powers of the people or that of the aristoi should prevail. Even the ever-combative Adams realized that this was heavily mined ground, so he began on an agreeable note. "Precisely," he told Jefferson, "the distinction between the few and the many was as old as Aristotle, and the timeless clash between them was the major reason he believed that the ancients had much to teach the moderns about politics." Having established some common ground, Adams then veered off in a direction that had always gotten him into political trouble, namely the inevitable role that elites play in making history happen. He recalled that it was Jefferson himself who had first encouraged him to write something upon aristocracy when they were together in London 30 years earlier. "I soon began and have been writing upon that subject ever since. I have been so unfortunate as never to make myself understood." "Your aristoi," he lectured to Jefferson, "are the most difficult animals to manage of anything in the whole theory and practice of government." In his defense, Adams had written 3 volumes of relentless and seemingly endless prose to show that political power invariably rested in the hands of a few prominent individuals and families. Whether it was the feudal barons of medieval France, the landed gentry of Elizabethan England, the merchant class of colonial New England, or the great planter families of the Chesapeake, history showed that the many always deferred to the few. Why? "I say it is the ordinance of God Almighty in the constitution of human nature and wrought into the fabric of the universe," Adams answered. "Philosophers and politicians may nibble and quibble, but they will never get rid of it. Their only resource is to control it." In the Adams formulation, aristocracies were to society as the passions were to the individual personality, permanent fixtures susceptible to disciplined containment and artful channeling, but never altogether removable. "You may think you can eliminate it," Adams warned, "but aristocracy, like waterfowl, dives for ages and rises again with brighter plumage." All the Jeffersonian chants about human equality were delusions that pandered to mankind's urge to believe an impossible dream. "Inequalities of mind and body are so established by God Almighty in the constitution of human nature," Adams declared, "that no art or policy can ever plane them down to a level." Jefferson's response took the form of 2 distinctions that together pointed in decidedly more optimistic directions. First, he agreed that there was a natural aristocracy among men based on virtue and talents. Then there was an artificial or pseudo-aristocracy founded on wealth and birth, without either virtue or talents. Was not the whole point of the Republican experiment they had helped to launch in America to provide for the selection of the natural aristocrats and block the ascendance of the artificial pretenders, thereby separating the wheat from the chaff? And had that, in fact, not occurred during and after the American Revolution, with the band of brothers he and Adams had come to symbolize being the obvious beneficiaries of the Republican selection process? Second, Jefferson suggested that Adams's description of aristocratic power was appropriate for Europe, where feudal privileges, family titles, and more limited economic opportunities created conditions that sustained class distinctions. In America, on the other hand, there were no feudal barons or family coats of arms, and everyone may have land to labor for himself as he causes. so the endurance of artificial elites was impossible. Jefferson noted somewhat gratuitously that perhaps in New England vestiges of feudalism remained and thereby misled Adams. In Massachusetts and Connecticut there still lingered a traditional reverence for certain families which has rendered the offices of government nearly hereditary in those families. In Virginia, however, laws abolishing primogeniture and entail had been passed during the Revolution. These laws, drawn by myself, laid the axe to the root of the pseudo-aristocracy, Jefferson claimed, thereby clearing the ground for the growth of political institutions based on merit and an admittedly imperfect form of equality of opportunity. Jefferson concluded on a gracious note. "I have thus stated my opinion on a point on which we differ," he observed, "not with a view to controversy, for we are too old to change opinions which are the result of a long life in inquiry and reflection, but on the suggestion of a former letter of yours that we ought not to die before we have explained ourselves to each other." Adams contested both of Jefferson's distinctions. Europe was, to be sure, burdened with aristocratic legacies and gross disparities in wealth that were not present to the same degree in America. But unless one believed that human nature underwent some magical metamorphosis in migrating from Europe to America, or unless one believed that the American Revolution had produced a fundamental transformation in the human personality, the competition for wealth and power would also yield unequal results in America. "After all," Adams observed, "as long as property exists, it will accumulate in individuals and families. I repeat it, so long as the idea and existence of property is admitted and established in society, accumulations of it will be made. The snowball will grow as it rolls." Jefferson's version of a classless American society was therefore a pipe dream, because the source of the problem was not European feudalism, but human nature itself. As far as Jefferson's description of Virginia's allegedly egalitarian conditions were concerned, no romance would be more amusing. Here, Adams confined himself to the still dominant role played by the planter class in the Chesapeake region, not even mentioning the fact that 40% of the population was enslaved, a feudal remnant of awesome and ominous proportions. "Finally," Adams apprised Jefferson, "your distinction between natural and artificial aristocracy does not appear to me well founded. One might be able to separate wealth from talent in theory, but in practice and in all societies they were inextricably connected. The five pillars of aristocracy," he argued, "are beauty, wealth, birth, genius, and virtues. Any one of the three first can at any time overbear any one or both of the two last. But it would never come to that anyway, because the qualities Jefferson regarded as artificial and those he regarded as natural were all mixed together inside human nature, then mixed together again within society in blended patterns that defied Jefferson's neat dissections." In a separate correspondence about the same time with John Taylor, another prominent Virginia planter and political thinker who had also questioned Adams's views on aristocracy, Adams called attention to the irony of the situation. The son of a New England farmer and shoemaker was being accused of aristocratic allegiances by an owner of slaves with vast estates, much of both inherited from his wife's side of the family. "If you complain that this is personal," Adams explained to Taylor, "I confess it, and intend it should be personal, that it might be more striking to you." Though precisely the same situation obtained for Jefferson as well, he owned about 200 slaves and 10,000 acres, a goodly portion inherited from his father-in-law, Adams never confronted him so directly. The closest he came was his running joke about the difference between Monticello and Montezillo. Adams was fully prepared to include Jefferson as a charter member of the natural aristocracy that made and then secured the American Revolution. Along with most of the Virginia dynasty, however, his ascent into the revolutionary elite was not the exclusive function of talent and virtue. What Adams could never quite fathom, and Jefferson understood intuitively, was that the very word aristocracy had become an epithet in the political culture of post-revolutionary America. Even though Adams was surely correct about the disproportionate power exercised by elites throughout history, and even though the revolutionary generation had succeeded in establishing a Republican government in large part because a small group of talented statesmen had managed the enterprise throughout its earliest and most vulnerable phases, a Republican aristocracy seemed the same contradiction in terms as a Republican king. It violated the central premise of the revolutionary legacy, namely that the people at large were the sovereign source of all political authority. Therefore, the only kind of political elite permissible was one that repudiated its elite status and claimed to speak for the many rather than the few. The Republicans had been the first to grasp this elemental fact of American political culture in the 1790s. The Federalists, who were no more a social or economic elite than the Republicans, had come to ruin because they never grasped it. Adams could argue till doomsday that the American experiment in republicanism had succeeded because it had managed to harness the energies and talents of its best and brightest citizens, the very band of brothers he and Jefferson supposedly symbolized, but as long as he referred to them as an aristocracy, whether natural or artificial, he seemed to be defying the Republican legacy itself. Another argumentative thread, which began in 1815 and then ran throughout the remainder of the correspondence, concerned the French Revolution. Adams loved to bring the subject up in his correspondence with others, especially Benjamin Rush, because events had tended to vindicate his early apprehensions, which had produced the first fissures in his relationship with Jefferson in the early 1790s, and then became central ingredients in the Republican polemic against Adams in the presidential campaign of 1800. But it was Jefferson who first broached the subject in the correspondence, and he did so in a wholly conciliatory way. "Your prophecies proved truer than mine, and yet fell short of the fact, for instead of 1 million, the destruction of 8 or 10 millions of human beings has probably been the effect of these convulsions. I did not in 1789 believe they would have lasted so long, nor have cost so much blood." Jefferson went on to acknowledge that Adams's critical perspective on the French Revolution had been a major source of his unpopularity. Now that Napoleon was finally defeated, word of Waterloo had just reached America, and the outcome was perfectly clear, Jefferson graciously observed that Adams was due an apology for the breach of confidence of which you so justly complain, and of which no one has more frequent occasion of fellow feeling than myself. Only someone thoroughly familiar with the political history of the 1790s could recognize what a major concession and personal confession of regret Jefferson was making. Adams caught the message immediately. "I know not what to say of your letter," he wrote, "but that it is one of the most consolatory I have ever received." For Jefferson was not only admitting that his optimistic assessment of events in revolutionary France had been misguided, he was also conceding that the Republican Party, to include himself, had played politics with the French Revolution in order to undermine the Adams presidency. Jefferson was making amends for what the Adams family had understandably regarded as the singular act of betrayal. He was saying, at last, that he was sorry. Adams suggested that Jefferson had misread the meaning of the French Revolution, sincerely misread it, and not just manipulated it for political purposes because of a faulty way of thinking, conveniently conveyed by the new French word ideology. Napoleon had popularized the word, which had first been used by the French philosophe Destutt de Tracy, whom Jefferson had read and admired enormously. Adams claimed to be fascinated by the new word upon the common principle of delight in everything we cannot understand. What was an ideology, he asked playfully. Does it mean idiotism, the science of non-compos menticism, the science of lunacy, the theory of delirium? As Adams explained it, the French philosophes had invented the word, which became a central part of their utopian style of thinking and a major tenet in their school of folly. It referred to a set of ideals and hopes, like human perfection or social equality, that philosophers mistakenly believed could be implemented in the world because it existed in their heads. Jefferson himself thought in this French fashion, Adams claimed, confusing the seductive prospects envisioned in his imagination with the more limited possibilities history permitted. Critics of Jefferson's visionary projections, like Adams, were then accused of rejecting the ideals themselves, when in fact they were merely exposing their illusory character. Ideology, then, had provided Jefferson with a politically attractive pro-French platform, which had turned out to have enormous rhetorical advantages, no matter how wrong it proved in reality. Jefferson had thought that France was the wave of the future, and England was a relic of the past. "I am charmed by the fluency and rapidity of your reasoning," Adams observed, "but I doubt your conclusion." England, not France, was destined to become the dominant European power of the 19th century, Adams correctly predicted, though he, like Jefferson, retained a deep suspicion of English designs on America, a permanent legacy of their mutual experience as American revolutionaries. They have been taught from their cradles to despise, scorn, insult, and abuse us, Adams wrote of the English, adding in his most relentlessly realistic mode that Britain will never be our friend till we are her master. Both Adams and Jefferson, it turned out, were too deeply shaped by the desperate struggle against England to foresee the Anglo-American alliance that flourished throughout the Victorian era and beyond. They both did anticipate, albeit from decidedly different perspectives, the looming sectional crisis between North and South that their own partnership stretched across. "I fear there will be greater difficulties to preserve our union," Adams warned, "than you and I, our fathers, brothers, disciples, and sons, have had to form it." Jefferson concurred, though the subject touched the most explosive issue of all, namely the unmentionable fact of slavery. Even the ever-candid Adams recognized that this was the forbidden topic, the one piece of ground declared off-limits by mutual consent. With one notable exception, the dialogue between Adams and Jefferson, so revealing in its engagement of the conflicting ideas and impulses that shaped the American Revolution, also symbolized the unofficial policy of silence within the revolutionary generation on the most glaring disagreement of all. The exception occurred in 1819, prompted by the debate then raging over passage of the Missouri Compromise. Prior to that time, Adams and Jefferson had not only avoided the subject in their correspondence, they had also independently declared the matter intractable. "More than 50 years has it attracted my thoughts and given me much anxiety," Adams confessed in 1817. "A folio volume would not contain my lucubrations on this subject, and at the end of it I should leave my reader and myself at a loss what to do with it, as at the beginning." For his part, Jefferson kept repeating the avoidance argument he had fashioned in 1805. I have most carefully avoided every public act or manifestation on that subject, he announced, explaining that the abolition of slavery was a task for the next generation, who can follow it up and bear it through to its consummation. Even though the congressional debate over the Missouri question was essentially an argument about the extension of slavery into the territories, the code of silence governed the lengthy exchanges in the House of Representatives, which focused exclusively on the constitutional question of federal versus state jurisdiction rather than on the problem of slavery itself. Jefferson, for his part, was outraged that the issue was being discussed at all. But the Missouri question is a breaker on which we lose the Missouri country by revolt, and what more, God only knows, he complained to Adams. From the Battle of Bunker's Hill to the Treaty of Paris, we never had so ominous a question. Jefferson understood full well that the constitutional argument over federal jurisdiction merely masked the deeper issue at stake, and he said so to Adams. The real question, as seen in the states afflicted with this unfortunate population, is, are our slaves to be presented with freedom and a dagger? For if Congress has a power to regulate the conditions of the inhabitants of states within the states, it will be but another exercise of that power to declare that all shall be free. Are we, then, to wage another Peloponnesian war to settle the ascendancy between them? That question remains to be seen, but not, I hope, by you or me. Surely they will parley a while, and give us time to get out of the way. Adams, usually the more apocalyptic member of the team, in this instance adopted the more sanguine Jeffersonian posture. I hope some good-natured way or other will be found out to untie this very intricate knot, he counseled. With his other correspondents, though not with Jefferson, he was much more forthright. Negro slavery is an evil of colossal magnitude, he wrote to William Tudor, and I am utterly averse to the admission of slavery into the Missouri Territory. What's more, he welcomed the very debate that Jefferson abhorred. We must settle the question of slavery's extension now, he told his daughter-in-law. Otherwise, it will stamp our national character and lay a foundation for calamities, if not disunion. As for the constitutional question, he regarded federal jurisdiction over the Western territories as a clear precedent that had been established, irony of ironies, by Jefferson's executive action in the Louisiana Purchase. Over the course of the next four decades, the national debate over slavery and its expansion into the West was often framed as an argument over the intent of the founders. Here were two of the unequivocally original patriarchs declaring that their respective understandings of the Revolution's legacy concerning slavery were fundamentally different. Jefferson's version led directly to the doctrine of popular sovereignty embraced by Stephen Douglas, to the states' rights position of John C. Calhoun and then the Confederacy. Adams's version led directly to the house-divided position of Abraham Lincoln, the conviction that abolishing slavery was a moral imperative bequeathed by the revolutionary generation to their successors, and the doctrine of federal sovereignty established by the victory of the Union in the Civil War. When it came to slavery, it would seem, there was no singular vision, only contradictory original intentions. The dominant legacy, of course, was avoidance and silence. Jefferson objected so strenuously to the debate over the Missouri question because it violated that legacy. In the gloomiest moments of the Revolutionary War, he wrote in 1820, I never had any apprehensions equal to what I feel from this source. In their last exchange on the topic, Adams suggested that he too would observe the unwritten code and carry his concerns to the grave. Slavery in this country I have seen hanging over it like a black cloud for half a century. I might probably say I had seen armies of Negroes marching and counter-marching in the air, shining in armor. I have been so terrified with this phenomenon that I constantly said in former times to the southern gentleman, I cannot comprehend this object. I must leave it to you. I will vote for forcing no measure against your judgments. Neither the Revolution nor the Infant Republic could have succeeded without the support of the southern states, so Adams had deferred to the Virginians to assume leadership of the anti-slavery movement. By 1820 it was abundantly clear that they had failed in this mission, with Jefferson himself the most visible symbol of the failure. But Adams chose to keep his vow of silence, at least with Jefferson, thereby honoring the etiquette of the friendship above his moral reservations, and simultaneously making the dialogue between Quincy and Monticello a final testament to the most problematic legacy of the revolutionary generation. The correspondence lost its argumentative edge and shifted back to an elegiac still-life pattern after 1820. One final flurry occurred in 1819, when a document appeared in the newspapers, purportedly drafted by a group of citizens in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, in May of 1775, and containing language eerily similar to Jefferson's later draft of the Declaration of Independence. Adams called Jefferson's attention to the discovery, noting that he wished he had known about it back then. I would have made the Hall of Congress echo and re-echo with it 15 months before your Declaration of Independence. Nothing could have been better calculated to activate all of Jefferson's interior antennae, since his primacy as the author of the Declaration was his major claim to everlasting fame. He responded promptly, insisting that this paper is a fabrication, urging Adams to remain skeptical until positive and solemn proof of its authenticity shall be provided. Adams quickly reassured Jefferson that he now believed that the Mecklenburg resolutions are a fiction. Meanwhile, however, he was telling other correspondents quite the opposite. I could as soon believe that the dozen flowers of the hydrangea now before my eyes were the work of chance, he joked, as that the Mecklenburg resolutions and Mr. Jefferson's declaration were not derived one from the other. Adams himself derived great satisfaction from the Mecklenburg incident, not so much because he believed Jefferson was a plagiarist, but because he thought the whole emphasis on one man, one moment, and one document distorted the true story of the American Revolution. Even though the Mecklenburg Declaration was subsequently exposed as a forgery, it accurately reflected the Adams sense that there were multiple venues or theaters where the drama of the movement for independence was playing out, and multiple culminating moments besides July 4, 1776. In his own memoirs, he had selected May 15, 1776 as the most decisive moment, because that was the day the Continental Congress passed a resolution calling for new constitutions in each of the states. Not so coincidentally, Adams had drafted and moved the resolution. In the Adams version, this decision was truly decisive because it created separate and independent American governments. It also meant that the revolution was a responsible and positive commitment to new forms of political discipline rooted in the experience of the old colonial governments, not just a negative assertion of separation from England and a complete break with the past, as Jefferson's declaration seemed to suggest. According to Adams, the revolution succeeded because of its ties to the past, which meant that in the Jeffersonian sense, it was not really a revolution at all. Though the brief exchange over the Mecklenburg Declaration touched on these significant differences of opinion, the diplomatic imperatives of the dialogue ruled out full disclosure. By 1820, even Adams had stopped firing off his illumination rounds and had adopted the Jeffersonian posture of benign duplicity, preferring to risk hypocrisy rather than the friendship. Though his prose remained pungent, the more dangerous bursts of candor had subsided, especially after Abigail passed away in October of 1818. As she lay in bed dying, Adams remained composed, but told the gathered relatives, "I wish I could lay down beside her and die, too." Jefferson had always claimed that each generation should not linger beyond its allotted time, that one had almost a moral obligation to clear the ground for the next generation by placing oneself beneath it. Now both patriarchs seemed to sense that they had outlived their time. "Looking back on life," wrote Jefferson, "was like looking over a field of battle, all dead, and ourselves left alone amidst a new generation whom we know not, and who know not us." The vicissitudes of aging began to crowd out the more controversial topics. "Crippled wrists and fingers make writing slow and laborious," Jefferson complained. "But while writing to you, I lose the sense of these things in the recollection of ancient times, when youth and health made happiness out of everything. I forget for a while the hoary winter of age, when we can think of nothing but how to keep ourselves warm, and how to get rid of our heavy hours, until the friendly hand of death shall rid us of all at once." Adams agreed that memories of the past were all that was left, and he too preferred to remember only the good ones. "I look back with rapture to those golden days when Virginia and Massachusetts lived and acted together like a band of brothers," he recalled. "And though the end was near, while I breathe, I shall be your friend." They referred to life in the hereafter not as a chance to see God so much as an opportunity to converse with each other and the other band of brothers. As Jefferson put it, "May we meet there again with our ancient colleagues and receive with them the seal of approbation." Adams concurred that the reunion in heaven would permit them to laugh at their human follies and foibles, though he would talk with Franklin only after the great man did proper penance for his sins. Neither man was completely convinced that heaven was anything more than a metaphor. Adams was on record as thinking that the belief in life everlasting was more important than the thing itself. "If it would be revealed or demonstrated that there is no future state," he apprised one friend, "my advice to every man, woman, and child would be, as our existence would be in our own power, to take opium." Or, as he put it to Jefferson, "If we are disappointed, we shall never know it." Each man was hedging his bets on the hereafter by preparing his private papers for posterity, the one place where they knew their prospects of immortality were assured. And both men regarded the letters they were writing to each other as the capstone to that final project. There is no question that the emotional bond between the two patriarchs was restored and the friendship recovered toward the end. They no longer had to pose as partners, or what amounts to the same thing. The posing reflected a deeply felt sense of affinity. In part, the bonding occurred because the correspondence of their twilight years permitted both sages to confront and argue out their different notions of the history they had lived and made together. Jefferson had made his amends and some crucial concessions. Adams had expressed his feisty and passionate objections to the Jeffersonian constructions in one last catharsis. One would like to believe, and there is some basis for the belief, that each man came to recognize in the other the intellectual and temperamental qualities lacking in himself, that they, in effect, completed each other, that only when joined could the pieces of the story of the American Revolution come together to make a whole. But the more mundane truth is that they never faced and therefore never fully resolved all their political differences. They simply outlived them. At the start of the correspondence, Adams had felt deep resentment toward Jefferson for the libels he had sponsored during the Adams presidency. By 1823, the whole subject of scandal had become a nostalgic joke. Adams read in the newspapers that Jefferson had compiled a magazine of slips of newspapers and pamphlets vilifying, calumniating, and defaming you. This was an inspired idea that Adams wished he had had first. "What a dunce I have been all my days, and what lubbers my children and grandchildren were, that none of us have ever thought to make a similar collection. If we had, I am confident I could have produced a more splendid mass than yours." Jefferson regretted to inform Adams that the story was untrue. He had not compiled a collection of the libels against himself. If he had, however, it would not indeed have been a single volume, but an encyclopedia in bulk. They had become living relics. In 1824, the Marquis de Lafayette, the great French champion of American independence, paid a final visit to America. Monticello and Quincy were obligatory stops on his tour. In each location, the reunion drew large crowds, in which witnesses claimed they saw two ghosts from a bygone era materializing one final time for the benefit of the present generation. The American sculptor John Henry Browera also visited both sages, who were asked to sit for life masks designed to produce reliable likenesses of their faces and heads, in effect, to make realistic icons of the icons. Jefferson found the process, which required pouring successive coats of a hot, plaster-like liquid over the head, so uncomfortable that he vowed to bid adieu forever to busts and portraits. His final adieu to Adams conveyed the same strange sense of being regarded as living statues. He entrusted his last letter to his grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, who was traveling to Boston and would make a stop in Quincy. "Like other young people, he wishes to be able in the winter nights of old age to recount to those around him what he has learnt of the heroic age preceding his birth, and which of the Argonauts particularly he was in time to have seen." For most Americans coming of age in the 1820s, the American Revolution had long since been enshrined as a sacred moment in the distant past, when a gallery of heroes had been privileged to see God face to face. It was awkward to realize that a few of them were still alive. But they were. And as the 50th anniversary of Independence Day approached, requests poured into Monticello and Quincy from across the land, asking the patriarchs to share their wisdom and memories about the meaning of it all. Though seriously ill with an intestinal disorder that would eventually prove fatal, Jefferson summoned up the energy for one final spasm of eloquence. For several days, he worked over the draft of a letter to the committee responsible for the Independence Day ceremonies in Washington, crossing out and revising the language with as much attention to detail as he had given the original declaration. He regretted that his deteriorating health prevented him from attending the ceremonies in person and joining the small band, the remnant of that host of worthies who joined with us on that day. Only three of the original signers survived: Adams, Jefferson, and Charles Carroll of Maryland. Then he offered the Jeffersonian version of what the host of worthies had done. "May it be to the world what I believe it will be, to some parts sooner, to others later, but finally to all, the signal of arousing men to burst the chains under which monkish ignorance and superstition had persuaded them to bind themselves, and to assume the blessings and security of self-government. All eyes are opened or opening to the rights of man. The general spread of the light of science has already laid open to every view the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. These are grounds of hope for others, for ourselves. Let the annual return of this day forever refresh our recollections of these rites and an undiminished devotion to them. Here was the vintage Jeffersonian vision. It viewed the American Revolution as an explosion that dislodged America from England, from Europe, from the past itself, the opening shot in a global struggle for liberation from all forms of oppression that was destined to sweep around the world. In this formulation, all forms of authority not originating within the self were stigmatized and placed on the permanent defensive. The American Revolution had not just repudiated the tyranny of the English king and parliament. It had defied all political institutions with coercive powers of any sort, including the kind of national government established by the Federalists in the 1790s. The inspirational rhetoric of the statement was not original. The phrases "saddles on their backs" and "a favored few, booted and spurred" had been lifted from a famous speech delivered by Colonel Richard Rumbold, a Puritan soldier convicted of treason in 1685, who spoke the words from the gallows. Jefferson owned several copies of English histories that reprinted the Rumbold speech. Perhaps as a dying man, like Rumbold, Jefferson thought he had every right to claim a favorite piece of eloquence as his own. But the borrowed rhetoric was only one small feature of a uniquely Jeffersonian message that was inherently rhetorical in character, that is, it framed the issues at a rarefied altitude where all answers were self-evident and no real choices had to be made. And that was the ultimate source of its beguiling charm. The Jeffersonian vision floated. It functioned at inspirational levels above the bedeviling particularities, like a Big Bang theory of the American Revolution, now destined to expand throughout the world naturally and inevitably, no longer in doubt or in human hands. Adams also received many requests from federal and state committees charged with organizing the celebration of what was being called the Jubilee of Independence. Irreverent to the end, for a time he resisted, insisting that the 4th of July was not really the right date. Indeed, there was no one right date, and the passage of the Declaration of Independence was merely an ornamental occasion bereft of any larger historical significance. When a delegation from Quincy came out to visit him to request words for a toast at the local celebration, he was curt. "I will give you independence forever," he replied. When asked to enumerate or explain, he refused. "Not a word," he insisted. Eventually, several family friends prodded a few amplifying rewards from the otherwise loquacious patriarch. He conceded that the era of the American Revolution had been a memorable epoch in the annals of the human race, but the jury was still out on its significance. He doubted whether the Republican principles planted by the founding generation would grow in foreign soil. Neither Europe nor Latin America were ready for them. Even within the United States, the fate of those principles was still problematic. He warned that America was destined in future history to form the brightest or blackest page according to the use or the abuse of those political institutions by which they shall in time to come be shaped by the human mind. Asked to pose for posterity, he chose to go out hurling it a challenge. The Adams formulation was precisely the opposite of Jefferson's. It lacked the lyrical eloquence and the floating optimism of the Jeffersonian version because it was grounded in the palpable sense of contingency Adams had internalized over his long career. For Adams, the American Revolution was still an experiment, a sail into uncharted waters that no other ship of state had ever successfully navigated. There were no maps or charts to guide a Republican government claiming to derive its authority and legitimacy from public opinion, that murky source of sovereignty that could be as choppy and unpredictable as waves on the ocean. He had been a member of the crew on this maiden voyage, even taken his turn at the helm, so he knew as well as anyone, better than most, that they had nearly crashed and sunk on several occasions, had argued bitterly among themselves throughout the 1790s about the proper course. Jefferson seemed to think that, once unmoored from British docks and unburdened of European baggage, the ship would sail itself into the proverbial sunset. Adams thought he knew better, and he also would go to his grave believing that a fully empowered federal government on the Federalist model was a fulfillment rather than a betrayal of the course they had set at the start. Without a sanctioned central government to steer the still fragile American Republic, the new crew was certain to founder on that huge rock called slavery, which was lurking dead ahead in the middle distance, and that even Jefferson acknowledged to be a breaker. The more providential Jeffersonian version of the story triumphed in the history books, as Adams knew it would, helped along by one final act of fate that everyone then and now regarded as the unmistakable voice of God. On the evening of July 3, 1826, Jefferson fell into a coma. His last discernible words, uttered to the physician and family gathered around the bedside, indicated he was hoping to time his exit in dramatic fashion. "Is it the fourth?" It was not. But he lingered in a semi-conscious condition until shortly after noon on the magic day. That same morning, Adams collapsed in his favorite reading chair. He lapsed into unconsciousness at almost the exact moment Jefferson died. The end came quickly, at about 5:30 that afternoon. He wakened for a brief moment, indicated that nothing more should be done to prolong the inevitable, then, with obvious effort, gave a final salute to his old friend with his last words, "Thomas Jefferson survives," or, by another account, "Thomas Jefferson still lives." Whatever the version, he was wrong for the moment, but right for the ages. This is Bob Walter. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Founding Brothers, The Revolutionary Generation by Joseph J. Ellis. This program was directed by Jessica Kay. Executive producer Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2000 by Joseph J. Ellis. Production copyright 2016 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.